Coming up next is the Professor James McCanny Science Hour at the Crossroads. Now on shortwave, WWCR, frequency 5.070 at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays, and also on Reality Radio Network Internet at www.realityradionetwork.com on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. And now, once again, here's your host, the Professor.
Good evening, November 2nd, 2006. And my main topic tonight will be somewhat of a review of Planet X-type topics. And this is because of the recent announcement by NASA that it has a full-fledged program based on the WISE satellite, infrared satellite, that will be surveying the sky in the next year or so to look for brown dwarfs. In other words, large Jupiter-sized planets, planet-type objects, actually small stars in their own right, that are in the vicinity of our solar system. And according to NASA, there are lots of these out there. And so, as I've in the past have talked about the many extra solar system objects that have to be around our solar system, it looks like NASA has finally gone public. And clearly, the reason being that these objects are clearly there. The public is fully aware of it. So to save face, they have to make some kind of public announcement and put themselves in the forefront of this topic. Otherwise, you might just get your information from someone like me. But this is most amazing after they've supported crazy people out there, lunatics, and then their own disinformation crew saying that there was no such thing as Planet X. Then you have the people that talk to aliens making up ridiculous stories like the Earth was going to end May 15, 2003, and on and on and on. And so it's almost comical that NASA would come out with a program where they put their lead man, obviously a very political Nobel Prize this year, and just after the announcement this September of that Nobel Prize in physics for a NASA scientist, isn't it interesting that he's put at the head of this search for Planet X? I wonder if they needed a little bit of boost there for credibility. But anyway, I'm not going to talk that much about that part of the topic. I'm going to talk about what probably NASA has already discovered and why the big push to announce to the public regarding their efforts to search for Planet X type objects, and what really are these objects, where might they come from. Certainly they do not fit into any traditional theory that NASA has ever supported regarding the formation of the solar system. So where on Earth or in the skies, in the heavens, did these things, where have they come from, how were they created, why are they part of our solar system, etc., etc. So I will be talking about that as the main science topic. First of all, a couple quick notes. There are some items that are on my webpage, and you can go there and buy them. I'm not going to spend a lot of time, but I just want to make you aware that these are items that I've found that are extremely important that I use myself, and they are items that you should also have in your collection of, oh, let's say, items to bring you into the future. And these include such valuable essentials as super silver solution. It's a solution. This is not colloidal silver. It's a new process for taking silver atoms, and they basically combine them with oxygen. I believe there's 5 or 6 oxygen atoms per silver atom. And there's a very interesting patented process that combines the oxygen with the silver, And what happens when it goes into your system, your system recognizes the oxygen, carries it through the bloodstream, and brings it into every cell in your body. And then the oxygen is released, and there you have the silver, which will fight viruses, bacteria, unwanted elements in your body. And silver, it turns out, has been used for millennia. The reason it was used for coinage is because when passed from hand to hand, the germs and that type of thing would not pass along with the coin. Very interesting. Or people would take a silver coin and throw it in milk before we had refrigeration, and the milk would not go bad. So it would keep the bacteria from growing in the milk. Silver has been used as for medicinal purposes for ages, and its effectiveness against viruses, bacteria, and other unwanted human ailments has been recognized, and the research is growing and growing. So a super silver solution, something that I would not be without. I use it on a daily basis because of many, many issues. You can use it topically. But this is on my webpage not because I'm just trying to sell something or make a buck, but because this is something you need. This is something you need in your arsenal of personal elements, things that you need that to take you into the future. So that's why it's there. And so I'm doing you a favor, putting it there, making it available to you, and giving you my personal recommendation. And of course, with everything, you have to research these yourself to make sure it's right for you. But my personal recommendation is you should have two bottles for every person in your household, and understand how to use it, and start using Super Silver Solution. I also have the Berkey water filters. And now just imagine, we live on a planet that is 3/4 water. Much of this, of course, in the form of salt seawater that you can't really drink, but you could in a pinch. Filter the salt water, or most of it, out of there and actually drink seawater. The Polynesians used to take their kids and very slowly start them on a program of drinking seawater. And you can't just do it cold turkey, as they say. You have to go on a very slow program. Take a little bit, the next day a little bit more. And they could actually drink seawater during their long ocean voyages because they were unable to carry fresh water with them. But be that as it may, most of us would want to drink fresh water, desalinized water, whatever. But isn't it amazing that only about 5% of the water on the planet is in liquid form? The other 95% is in ice caps on the Greenland ice cap. And in Antarctica, that's where about 95% of the world's water, fresh water, is contained. So isn't it amazing that, by the way, there's some vast aquifers also in the world, but isn't it amazing that there are people, particularly in the UN, and also, for example, the Bushes are big right now in trying to control and garner control of the water resources of South America. You've got George, who's apparently has sent envoys down to Paraguay to secure vast amounts of land, and apparently one of the reasons is because that land also has vast aquifers underneath. And then you have George Sr., ex-president, working with a Canadian company to force indigenous people out of the region, the boundary between Argentina and Chile, to build a giant reservoir. So you can see there's some people in what we call the New World Order who are very busy around this planet securing water rights on a vast scale. So at any rate, the point being that there may come a time in the maybe not so distant future when you will be your only source of fresh water. So you might ask the question, how could there be a water shortage on a planet that is three-quarters water on the surface, and which has vast amounts of fresh water, both liquid form in lakes and in reservoirs, but and also in the form of glaciers and ice caps? How could there possibly be a water shortage? Well, there is. There is already a water shortage. And when you see that droughts can be manipulated with weather control, another source of water manipulation, and flooding is another form of water manipulation where, with tremendous flooding, the water is rendered useless because you have so much water, it brings all the pollutants up out of the ground, and basically, in most flooded areas, animals die, etc., float in the water, and it's the putrefaction of animals is a major source of cholera and other diseases that grow in areas where there's flooding. So by controlling drought and flooding areas, you can control the water sources that people need, the clean sources. So the bottom line is you are your only source of fresh water. For that reason, I have the Berkey water filter. And if I left my house for some reason, or if I went on a survival trip, or even if I'm just living in my house, the one thing that I will have is my water filter. And I use it on a daily basis. You should be using it on a daily basis. One very large, great possibility is the possibility of a terrorist attack using the water system. And the Berkey will filter out anything that they can throw at you. So I would definitely be using a water filter on a daily basis. And this is a gravity feed water filter. You don't need pressure from the line to make this work. And if you are ever in an emergency and you have to like make a run for it, whether it's man-made, whether it's a natural disaster, or whether you're just going on a camping trip, the Berkey filter you can pick up and carry it with you. The filter itself, the containers in the filter, only weigh a few pounds. And you could actually store stuff in it that you were carrying with you. So it's the one thing that I would take with me no matter what. And at any rate, I'm just going to quick give the 800 number, 800-983-5622. Excuse me. No, it's 800-983-5622. And, you know, it's like I say, this is helping you help yourself. I put these in front of you, and it's something I highly recommend that you look into and obtain for yourself, because there will be a day, as it says in the ancient literature, that a glass of water will be the most precious thing on the face of the earth. And by the way, another thing I have in my webpage deals with cell phone technology, neutralizing the damaging effects of cell phones. This on the jmcanniescience.com homepage. If you're listening on the shortwave, go to jmccsci.com. And interestingly enough, national news has started to break the story that cell phone use is damaging. The recent story that hit national news, I believe last night only, said that it's now becoming convinced that it can cause genetic damage in children. But there's a way to combat this. BioPro has the exclusive worldwide distribution on the technology developed by German scientists for the Russian space program to neutralize the damaging effects of RF radiation. So I'm not going to go into detail here. Go to my webpage and look at the details there. Once again, educate yourself. Now, on to the first topic of the night. The Deep Impact spacecraft of NASA is heading off to visit a new comet. And the name of that comet is that will be near the near Earth's orbit when the spacecraft reaches it in 2008, in December of 2008, just about, what would that be? 2 years, a little over 2 years from right now, Comet Boethyn. And this comet was chosen because right now it's around the orbit of Saturn, halfway or two-thirds of the way out into the solar system. But by the time the spacecraft, the deep impact spacecraft, which visited Comet Tempel 1, July 4th, 2005, and you may remember that I was on the Coast to Coast AM radio show on July 4th with other guests talking about the data that came off of that spacecraft and the fact that it really did not show us a dirty snowball. But at any rate, it will be heading out to visit another comet in December of 2008. Now, the last couple of nights, we saw the Northern Lights. And just a second here, having a little... sorry about that. I had a slight technical difficulty here on the board. The Northern Lights were displaying themselves quite eloquently the past couple nights, and some people called up and they asked me, what causes the Northern Lights? And I've been asked this on radio shows where I've been guest, etc. Here's what happens. Earth is surrounded by a magnetic field. It's partly internal to the Earth, and then there are rings of current which surround Earth. And also there's the flow of electrical current that's coming off of the sun passing by the Earth. And all of these contribute to our magnetic field. Electrical currents that pass by us in outer space and are coming down the tail region of the planet. This is the electrical tail that extends out into space on the non-sunward side. We also have an electron beam coming in from the sunward side, because Earth basically electrically looks just like a comet. Excuse me. But back to the Northern Lights, the electrical currents come in from the sunward side and from the anti-sunward side and funnel down in through the magnetic field lines that are at the North and South Pole. So basically, if you look at this from a satellite view from out in outer space and look down on Earth, there's an actual donut-shaped ring that is always there with the Northern Lights, where the electrical current comes in from outer space, drives down into the atmosphere, and in the very high upper atmosphere, the oxygen and nitrogen and other molecules are interact with this electrical current, causing these molecules to fluoresce, just like a neon light bulb. So the electrical currents, the energy coming in from these particles, hits the molecules up in the upper atmosphere, causing them to fluoresce, and you get these beautiful curtain patterns and all the various patterns of the Northern Lights. And sometimes when this electrical current becomes intense enough, that donut spreads out and goes farther south from the North Pole down to the northern latitudes of the United States, and we get or into Canada. If you're up on the Canadian border, or in Canada, or up in Alaska, for example, or in Siberia, you would see the Northern Lights quite regularly. Most people don't talk about the southern aurora because there's really not a lot of land down there. Most of the land on Earth is in the northern hemisphere, if you look at a map or a globe of the Earth. So people don't regularly look at the southern auroral activity because there's just not a lot of land down there. But if you're an ocean traveler and happen to be in that part of the globe down south, you would also see the aurora, the electrical currents coming into Earth. So last few nights, the aurora quite active. Now, there's a topic that is need some clarification. I've talked before many times, and of course Velikovsky talks about the two Venus encounters based on the Mayan codex, or the accounting of the ancient Mayans dealing with their number system and their calendar system. And by the way, if you have seen or heard anything about 2012, the year 2012, being the end of the world, there's no prediction in the Mayan calendar about the world ending in 2012. And very poorly researched, unfortunately. The Mayans had many calendars, and so you have to understand all of them before you start talking about calendars or predictions. But the one thing that is very clear about the Mayan calendar is it's based on the cycles of Venus, on the sidereal cycles of Venus. Now, Venus, every 584 days, comes into inferior conjunction with Earth. In other words, the Earth and Venus align with the Sun. Now, this cycle, if you look at it on a 52-year basis, the position of Earth and Venus and the Sun relative to the celestial coordinates, they come back and meet up exactly in the same place every 52 years. So the modern Mayan calendar, which is different from the ancient Mayan calendar, by the way, the modern Mayan calendar cycles every 52 years based on the cycles of Venus. So that's something I try and always impress on people when talking about the Mayan calendar. It's not primarily based on the Sun or the Moon or any of the other planets. It is based on the cycles of Venus. And that's very important, because why would Venus, this little dot in the sky, be of importance to the Mayans? Well, it turns out that their ancient calendar, from which the modern calendar is derived, and the number system, the number system that the Mayas used, now is based on an ancient event that happened an estimated 3,500 to 4,000 years ago, and it's very difficult to put an exact date on this because of the change in calendars that occurred when Venus came by Earth on two different occasions and basically altered the Earth's orbit, its tilt axis, and changed the location of our North Pole. And this is, for example, the reason why the mastodons, tropical animals, were flash frozen and now sit in the tundra, frozen with tropical plants in their mouth and gullet. These are tropical plants that weren't even digested in the mouths of these animals, and they were flash frozen while they stood in place, because the Earth, simply the whole mantle of the Earth shifted by about 30 to 35 degrees. But that's not the point of this discussion. The point I want to make is that the modern Mayan calendar looks at the cycles of Venus and the alignment of Venus with the Sun, and the myth or the mythology that goes along with this is that every 52 years the Mayan calendar cycles, and if Venus does not, which is, by the way, Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky, which represents the imagery of the comet form of Venus when it was a vast comet thousands of years ago, raging through the solar system. That's what alleviated Mars of its atmosphere and oceans just prior to coming and encountering Earth. But the point is that the modern cyclical redundancy period, the period of alignment with Earth, is 52 years, where the, as I say, the sidereal cycles of Venus come back and line up, and Earth and Venus and the Sun are perfectly aligned in the same spot in the celestial sphere every 52 years. So the modern Mayan calendar is refined based on the path that Venus is moving in right now, which is very different from the path that it moved on as it came through the solar system as a large comet. So what I want to say here, and this is for people who are especially tuned to my work and tuned to what Velikovsky was saying, I have to make a modification, and a lot of people who are tuned to my work will certainly be able to understand this, that the 52-year period is the modern construct, kind of like mythology with a modern twist to it. But back in the ancient days, the period of the Earth's orbit, the number of days in a year, etc., apparently was quite different. And people who are experts at dealing with calendars, not the fly-by-nighters you see on the internet today, but people who have really researched and studied this, know that the calendars did change. And so what I'm saying is that we could estimate that it was a 52 to 54 year period between the two events, the two Venus events, the first and the second one, where the first event did a certain amount of damage to Earth, but it was the second one that really took Earth down to its knees at that time. And that's the cause of the Great Flood, the tilt of the Earth's axis, and all of the other effects talked of by Velikovsky. It's my estimation that it could have been the first Venus event that took Atlantis down, which is another one of the unsolved mysteries. When exactly did Atlantis go under? But at any rate, there's a lot of history that indicates that that could be the case. But the point is that there's no way of knowing for sure if it was 52 or 54 years or a different number of years that elapsed between the first Venus encounter and the second one. And that's something that I delve into every now and then. I try and work on that problem and look at literature. But it's one of the unsolved problems because the modern cycle of Venus is very different from the orbit that Venus was in when it was a large comet. So I just want to clarify that. And like many mythologies and many religions, it's become standardized, and the Codex of the Maya on its current basis, based on the cycles of Venus, which was standardized and solidified over hundreds, if not thousands of years from the original Maya. We'll call them Maya because we really don't have a good name. The predecessors actually to the Olmecs, who lived in Mexico, southern Mexico and Central America, the descendants of the true Maya, the people that lived during, actually witnessed the two Venus events and went under, were absolutely devastated. But at any rate, that's a rather complicated esoteric topic, but one that I really wanted to bring out because it needed clarification to understand that, in summary, the two Venus events in history, this is when Venus was a comet moving through the solar system, encountered Earth on two occasions, causing tremendous damage, much more so on the second encounter, that there's no way of knowing for sure that it was a 54-year spacing or 52 years because the calendars were thrown into such disarray at that time. Anyway, on to the next topic. Which brings us into the topic of Planet X. And this is the main topic I want to get to tonight. First one, just a small aside note. It was announced this past week that there are now 100 million websites on the worldwide internet, on the World Wide Web. Actually, on the internet, because a lot of these sites really are not on the WWW, the World Wide Web, and which is, in a sense, a subset or another portion of the what we call the internet. Now, 100 million sites. Very interesting, and in this growing field where people can have a site, organizations, every corporation, small and large, has an internet site, informational sites. You have things like Wikipedia, which is now in multiple languages. There's a tremendous propensity for misinformation, for wannabes, crackpots, quacks, imposters, people trying to present themselves as people who they really aren't, people claiming to have PhDs who don't, on and on and on. People who provide information on their website based on information they basically borrowed, stole, or adopted from somebody else and claiming that they are the authors of said material, that type of thing. So it's important for the reader to understand what the internet is, and it's good, it's great, because for the first time, the world has what you would call a free press. But it's like a college student that just went off to college for the first time, and his parents have been guarding him tightly, as our news media has guarded our information tightly over the past 100 years, let's say. And all of a sudden, the news or the ability to get information out there has been sprung loose, like a new freshman gone off to college who was tightly guarded at his home by his parents. And lo and behold, it has gone crazy. So it's up to the reader to beware. I recently talked to an English teacher of a high school and got on the topic of Wikipedia. And much to my dismay, they said that the main reference that kids were using today to do research was Wikipedia, because no matter what topic they would type in, up would come Wikipedia as either the top or possibly the second choice. And they would go there not understanding that Wikipedia is really a giant mess of people entering information. There's no standardization. There's no ability to find out who people are. So it's a conglomeration. It's kind of a blending of all of the garbage on the internet. And people go, well, gee, I've gone to Wikipedia and it had some good information. Well, sure, but there are certain topics where you will find a lot of very bad information, and science, space science especially, and let's say alternative energy is another one where you'll find some good information and some very distorted information at the same time. So, for people who are not familiar with who the players are, etc., it's very difficult to pick out the misinformation, the intentionally planted misinformation, from the real information. And unfortunately, a lot of the information on the internet is drawn from other sources, then people add information, etc. And that's why I don't post on other people's web pages. I keep control of my own information, because it gets out there and then somebody starts altering it or whatever, and before you know it, it's a big mess. And that's, for example, the copycat sites who try and copy my information. You have a bunch of quacks and imposters, and they really don't know what they're talking about. So as the web has grown to 100 million sites, it's a kind of a wake-up call where people have to start becoming savvy to what is misinformation, what's bogus, and what's real. So, at any rate, hopefully the information in the world will grow and prosper, but along with it come the charlatans the opportunists, who are going to try and make mark on the planet, unfortunately, at the expense of everybody else. So on to the topic of brown dwarfs. Now, NASA, as I said, and I've kind of harped on this, I've got postings on my webpage, has a program which they announced this past week, a very interesting timing, And I'll preface it by saying that for many years they've had outreach and other low-level, what I call Tier 3 astronomers out there saying that there is no such thing as Planet X, that the solar system is well known. And these are kind of textbook responses to the issue of the question of whether there could be other large objects out there that we don't know about that could be hovering around the solar system or that could have come through on a historically recent or far distant past and done damage to the solar system, including our planet Earth. And so the question is, all of a sudden NASA is making this announcement, putting its Nobel Prize, 2006 Nobel Prize winner, Mather, on the very top front edge of this search, using the newly announced, or not really newly announced, but the new to be launched satellite called WISE, the infrared search satellite, doing an automated search in the deep infrared, very cool objects out there searching for, and clouds that are surrounding objects. But they said something very interesting in the news release, that 99% of the sky has not been surveyed yet. But they didn't talk about the 1% that had been surveyed to this type of accuracy. So that's telling me that NASA has done some studies, and as they looked out to the 1% of the sky, the region of the sky, 1% of it they surveyed to this accuracy using infrared, looking for very cool objects out there. Apparently they've found enough of them to warrant launching a satellite and putting their Nobel Prize winning physicist at the head of the project. Now, that's very interesting. So the question that the public would be asking, the question I want to answer on this show in the next 20 minutes, is where did these objects come from? Clearly, they don't fit into any sort of traditional theory dealing with the formation of the solar system. You're told through textbooks or newspaper, magazine articles, or through web pages, official mouthing agencies like space.com, etc., that mouth the NASA party line. You're told that the solar system formed 4.5 billion years ago and nothing has changed since. All the planets are in the orbits that they were back then. Venus, Mercury, Earth, our moon, all of these were around for ages and ages, all forming at about the same time. But clearly that's not the case. Only a year and a half ago, NASA made an announcement that at least 12 of the moons of Saturn had to be recent acquisitions. That means capture. That means they were brought in from someplace else. And we're not just talking about little moons here. We have some problems with some of the big moons that just don't fit. You look at the four big moons of Jupiter, physically, geologically, they're totally diverse. None of them looking anything like the other ones. So did these all form at the same time, out of the same matter, out of the same localized cloud of dust? No, they didn't, and it's very obvious. So then we're told that by vote, by astronomers just a few months ago, that there are only 8 planets now, not 9. Pluto's been demoted because the other option was to include about 50 other objects out there that are Pluto-sized that all want to be planets because they're round. They're in orbits similar to planetary-type orbits. But what were astronomers going to do? Keep adding daily, almost, to the list of objects that we would call planets? And that would kind of strike an ill note to their theory that the planets all formed at one time and that there were only 9 of them. So, at any rate, Pluto supposedly is no longer a planet. And by the way, I'm going to continue to call Pluto a planet. In fact, it's not only a planet, it's a twin. It's a binary planet with its moon, round spherical moon, Charon. So there are many planets. I don't call Saturn and Jupiter planets, and I've talked about this before, because they are small unlit stars. Now, something Velikovsky talked about was the fact that potentially, and from ancient information, it's possible that both Jupiter and Saturn ignited for a short period of time in ancient historical times, when the ancients saw these and talked about them igniting as small stars. So isn't it interesting that the Cassini mission satellite around Saturn and also the Galileo mission that was at Jupiter both found tremendous amounts of heat pouring out of these planets, which are, as I say, truly small stars. But the real question is, how could there be many, not one, but many brown dwarf, Jupiter-type objects that are way out in the far reaches of our solar system that have never been detected, and all of a sudden NASA is very interested in finding out what is out there, to the point that, as I said, they put their Nobel Prize-winning physicist at the head of the pack searching for these, with a very expensive satellite whose main mission is to look for these and to cloak it under the name of a satellite that would catalog distant galaxies. Very strange behavior, but certainly a public admission that these objects are out there. So where did these form? Where do they come from? It certainly doesn't fit into the traditional concept of a solar system. And apparently, a lot of these objects, and here's one of the main points, they're not in nice circular orbits. Some of the recent planetary discoveries show that these objects are in very obtuse, very elongated elliptical orbits, one of them being as close to the Sun as it will ever get, being three times the distance to Pluto, and it goes out to 98 times the distance to Pluto in the farthest reaches of its orbit. So clearly there are many objects out there like this, of many different sizes, and I've talked about this as a guest on radio shows and also on this radio show, that you look at the size distribution of objects and say you find a Sedna-type object, the newly discovered planet, which, by the way, is no longer allowed to be a planet because it's been voted out of existence from being a planet. But clearly, it is a planet. It has all the qualifications of being a planet by anybody's rational definition of a planet. It's round, it's big. It has a surface ice sheet, apparently, on it, so it had an atmosphere at one time. And it certainly formed by some planetary formation process. It's not an asteroid. The point being that the solar system is far more dynamic, and we certainly have the potential for these objects that could be coming in at any time, from the far reaches of outer space, from beyond the planets where we can now visibly detect them with even the best technology telescopes that we have available today. Where did these objects come from? How were they formed? Well, to talk about this, let's go back to a galaxy formation model that I have a paper that was published in the peer-reviewed astrophysics journals in 1980, called Continuing Galactic Formation. And what happens is, as the stars flow out of the galactic nucleus area, there's a vast number of individual objects that are thrown out in the arms of the solar system, and so eventually they become captured by the main solar system, of which we had Jupiter and the Sun as the first two members, all of the rest of the planets being captured at a later date. So it would not be too difficult to imagine that then in this capturing process that's been going on for a very long time, billions, certainly billions of years since our sun formed in that process near the galactic nucleus and was flung out into the galactic arms, that we have acquired a whole entourage of these objects. And some of them may be very distant. Some of them may come in every, let's take for example, it's been said that there's an object called Wormwood, Nibiru, Planet X, whatever you want to call it, that comes in every 3,600 years. And that, by our current reckoning, is simply not possible, because we do have a decent record going back that far, and there's a lot of confusion about the Venus event. Now, Venus came in and became a planet. The tail drag of the comet circularized the orbit, caused eccentricity dampening, which changes its elliptical orbit into a circular orbit, and as it became, the orbit became circularized, the tail activity died down, and we're left with the planet Venus that we see today. So the celestial mechanics of how this functions is completely explained in my papers dealing with cometary activity. But imagine that there are many objects out there that have not gone through this final adoption into our solar system, and they come in possibly every 4,000, 10,000, 100,000 million years, whatever the case may be, and we simply don't have any record in our human existence of these, other than the fact that books like the Colbran, which, by the way, remember that there's only one true source of the Colbran. Go to the ChaldeanTrust.org webpage and don't bother with the imitation Colbran that you'll find on Amazon.com with a round orange ball on the front. That is not the Colbran. That's a bootleg book. If you made the mistake of buying that, send it back, get your money back, and go to the true source of the Colbran, which is the Chaldean webpage, which is the only source of the Colbran. The Colbran is a large, beautiful book, richly bound, and you can have a real version of the Colbran. And I highly suggest that you get that, because it does talk about the ancient comets very clearly. The ancient comets, there were sometimes many of them in the solar system at one time. And that's because when one of these very large objects comes into the solar system, it has many companions or orbiting bodies. It's like a mini solar system in its own right. So all of these objects form comets as they come into the within the solar capacitor, discharge the solar capacitor, and become comets. And some of them, now this is the scenario that I've created for where the planet Venus came from. It came in, I would estimate, along with this object that people like to call Planet X, or Wormwood, the Wormwood, Planet X, Nibiru, being the very large object which is in orbit around our sun, and possibly does come in every 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 years, possibly. But it brings in an entourage of other objects, and that's where Venus, the comet, came in. It was captured by Jupiter, according to ancient legends. Of course, they saw it born of Jupiter, and it probably encountered the other planets, possibly Saturn, at the same time, but ultimately was captured into the plane of the planets. It became a large comet and was captured and ultimately encountered Earth on two occasions. Previous to that, encountered Mars, removed the atmosphere and oceans from Mars, and ultimately, after the encounters with Earth, settled into the orbit where we see it today. Another member of that entourage was what we call Hale Bopp, coming in from that southern region that's only visible in the merry month of May. And that's why astronomers and the disinformation crew like to put all their disinformation campaigns in May, because they know that that could be the only month when the public, the amateur astronomers, would be able to see any objects coming in from that southern part of the solar system. But at any rate, be that as it may, there may be many, many other objects of which we know nothing, possibly larger than Nibiru. We have many mass extinction events on this planet. Clearly, the planet Earth has gone through serious changes throughout its history. Geological changes, mountain building, changes in ocean levels, moraines building and dropping, pieces of land which don't belong in their surroundings. These are called moraines. So Earth has seen some definite disastrous changes. But what I've found out too is that after these changes, even in the case of Mars, where it was completely relieved of its atmosphere and oceans, it's rebuilding them quite rapidly. Mars' atmosphere has almost doubled in size over the past 10 years. So the atmospheres are regained, the planets renew, they start building up life again, and so there's a very dynamic change going on in the solar system, and that's why I repeatedly say that man has a very short time span to get its act together. And the main impetus, the main focus that man should have is getting into outer space with large populations and learning how to live in outer space so we can distribute these human colonies around the solar system for the survival of the species. But it's simply not going to happen based on the kind of space program we have today, where aerospace corporations and executives make all the money and really not a lot is going on in space. So, but on to this topic of the objects out there. Where did they form? Well, most of them formed possibly in this outrushing of material that came out from the galactic nucleus when the solar system formed. And remember that our solar system typically originally had just the Sun and Jupiter as the main members, and then they captured the rest of the members over a long period of time. So it's not unusual to imagine that not only is there a vast array of these larger objects out there, but far more objects, many more objects, smaller objects that can come into the solar system at any time. So let's say we have 9 planets, 40 large moons, and maybe 10,000 relatively small comets and hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of asteroids. This is what we consider our solar system entourage right now. But the objects out there that are in elliptical orbits that only come in once in a great while are very much a part of our solar system, and it's a very much an unknown part of our solar system. Thus, you have the NASA program to go search for at least the largest items out there. And there's no doubt that they're going to discover them. The question is if they discover some, and I believe they already have discovered some, that have potential to do damage to Earth. People look at the crazy maneuverings that are going on in the background today with world leaders. And what I always tell people is, if things don't make sense, then you're looking at it the wrong way. You don't have the right basis with which to analyze, say, the political moves going on in the world. And that's why people sometimes criticize me on this show for talking about politics. Well, if you put it in context that in the near future, whether it's in 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years, 20 years, or 200 years, these people know that some large object is going to come into the solar system and devastate this place, they're going to want to ride out and be on the top whenever they come out of the other side. They're also using the vast resources of this planet to make a great location for themselves, and they don't care about the rest of the people. So when you look at what's going on in the world, the positioning of, for example, the Bushes buying land in Paraguay, or maneuvering with China, or the New World Order, or garnering the rights to water rights around the world, now you can understand, now this makes a lot of sense if you understand that these people are positioning themselves worldwide to be the rulers on the other side of any such event. Then things start to make sense. Why would you have all the laws put in place to hold down insurrections like the ones that were just passed, unless you thought there was a real need that the public actually was going to rise up and destroy the people that we currently call our government? Why would they do that? Why would there be a need? You don't typically pass laws unless there's a need for them. What I'm saying here is when you understand the significance of NASA's announcement that they are now on a full-fledged program to search not for one, not for many, but potentially thousands of Planet X-type objects out there. Planet X, by the way, meaning any object that simply has not been named yet by the astronomical community. So Planet X is a generic term for any object of a planetary type that has not been named yet. And they believe through this announcement there are thousands of them out there. And, of course, I've been talking about this throughout my entire career. So, and you'll find that the disinformation sites will continue to try and make this into a crazy topic or deny the fact that these objects could exist out there. Well, NASA, obviously, all along has had a program. They had a program throughout the 80s headed by Harrington at the Naval Observatory to search for Planet X. That was the title of the paper, of the search that NASA had underway throughout the 80s, the search for Planet X. So obviously they've known about this. It's been pushed underground. They've helped support crazy people who've tried to make this a crazy topic. And the only avenue NASA has right now is to try and pretend like they're world leaders in the search for these objects and put their Nobel Prize winning physicist at the head of this project. So isn't that interesting? Certainly you wouldn't do that unless you wanted some notoriety and some, let's say, some support for your particular project. So at any rate, are they going to find some? Well, they already have. Are they going to find more? Yes. Are they going to find more that are potentially going to create damage to Earth? Yes. The big question is, will they tell you about the dangerous ones? Absolutely not, is the answer. Because when the other planetary objects were discovered, remember that Sedna and some of the other planets that we've seen in the outer solar system were discovered during the May timeframe, 2003, when all the crazy predictions of Planet X were going on in the NASA-supported program, where somebody seemed to be talking to aliens. At any rate, you can start to see the goofiness and the end result of what is going on today. So this is a huge topic, and it needs to be discussed in terms of NASA changing directions all of a sudden, making public that it does have a full-fledged, high-level support program searching for Planet X. And I'm out of time. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.